Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway once again, and we are happy to be here, aren't we, folks? Yay!
Yay!
I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Next to me here is Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
Good morning.
Good day. Whatever time of day it happens to be
whenever,
to our people
whenever,
as they listen.
Wherever you're listening.
And Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. This could be playing, in fact, it probably is, when they play it in Waxahachie, Texas, and Evansville, Indiana. It's probably playing at 4 a.m., so it really is good.
That's when I listen to radio.
Well, you do.
BBC,
yes, nobody else does.
But let me ask you a question, Rex, because I want to start us off with it. You know, I mean, what is it? You write columns. I write a column every week or two every week. And some of the throwaway columns, because, you know, columnists always need a column.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to find something to write on.
Mm-hmm.
I find when my deepest and best thinking, talking about politics and, you know, all the rest of it, eh. But let me write about the woodchuck that is on our land, and I get 100 letters, or that may be an exaggeration, but a lot of people stopping by on the street and saying, yeah, I had one of those bears or woodchucks or something there. So, you know, you guys are both editors of fabulous newspapers, and my question to both of you is, do you have to sort of equivocate between substantive, important news and what you know your readers are going to be interested in, the damn bear or the fox?
It's true. It's a mix. We have a poll on our site right now. Should cats be kept indoors? And we got a lot of comments and a lot of votes.
And the answer was?
People think the cat should be kept indoors and not allowed outside. Now I have
really?
An outside cat. Please.
Because what happens? They eat the birds?
They could get diseases. They could bother the neighbors.
Right.
And this is crucial for America.
The cat problem. Well,
what Judy's saying is that you have to have some of the lighter stuff to go along with the heavy. It's always a mix of the broccoli and the ice cream.
Such a banal answer.
But it's true.
But it's very true.
Yeah, but you know, as opposed to
our program here where we don't do anything frivolous on this show. No.
No.
It's all serious.
No, it's mostly serious. And then people, if you don't get serious, then there's always somebody with their nose up in the air who calls and says, cut out the giggling and don't want to hear any more of that anymore.
Yeah.
You know.
Here we have one of our listeners, in fact, who might take that point of view. Donald in Kane in New York says, Alan, I am disappointed that the media is calling the Higgs boson particle the God particle. He says, I doubt if God wants a particle named after him. I think it shows disrespect to people who believe in God or a God under another name, me being one. This is purely media driven and needs to stop. So,
whatever.
Fine. It's not purely media driven, and I think that every time that I have seen the reference to the term God particle, it has been explained that the scientists who work on it actually hate that term, but it has been was referred to that by a book.
Yeah, so you're playing it so safe, aren't you, Rex? Judy?
But again, true. It's true. I don't think the God particle term came from the media. I think we're reporting what people talk about, and then we do put it in context.
Well, the fact that you even keep repeating it and calling it so-called doesn't really get you off the hook. I think this man is absolutely right. God is an important part of that person's life.
Indeed.
He believes in it. And I would be the last person to make fun of that or to in any way put my tongue in my cheek or anything else, because I would not do that.
But you do want people to read the article. And I think sometimes when they use that term, God particle, it will draw someone's attention to a story that they haven't read before.
It helps people to understand. Yeah. They need to know what you're talking about. And it's a short form. I mean, you can
fit
in there.
Why do you keep using the word short? I want to go back to the cat for a minute. Once a year, I like to tell the cat story. Perhaps I've already told it this year.
I don't know the cat story.
I was, as you know, for many years on Channel 6, and Channel 6 had a
CBS affiliate here in Albany.
Yes, they had a reporter, should not be mentioned now because I wouldn't want to embarrass anybody, and they were doing an exclusive story. They put exclusive across the page, at the top, and it was about somebody who had tortured a cat. They had tortured the cat. They got more mail about this than anything else. This is reprehensible. This is terrible, and the rest of it. Well, one day, communism came down. It was the end. There's the wall and the end of communism. The biggest story of the year of the century.
Yeah.
And says, I hope they don't lead with the GD cat. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, they led with the cat. I just wanted to tell that story one more time because I think it says all.
Well, sometimes people love to hear animal stories.
It says something, but it doesn't say all.
Yeah. Absolutely. Fox News deceptively edited President Obama's remarks to make it seem as though he was claiming that small business owners do not deserve any credit for their own success. Now, here's the deal. Obama was appearing in Roanoke, Virginia, and he was arguing that while small business owners' individual talents and their drive allow them to achieve the American dream, they also stand on other people's shoulders. Outside influences such as he said, a great teacher somewhere in your life, an investment in roads and bridges. But on Fox and Friends, they cropped it so that all he said was, if you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen. Rush Limbaugh subsequently picked it up and used that as the basis for an attack in which he said, Obama hates America. So what do we make of that kind of thing?
We make that it's reprehensible. Look, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. The new thing is the subtleties of not only inaccuracies, but race. I've been thinking about this race thing a lot, and we're hearing more and more references in which then somebody talks about, you know, watermelon or this or that, and then apologizes, says, okay, I went too far. I shouldn't have said that. Meantime, the dam is broke, and some of these people are on radio. Some of them are politicians. They are introducing it into the mix, and I have a feeling a lot more of this election is going to be about race than a lot of Americans would like it to be, because I think racism has been a part of the American psyche for a long time. And I do think that's where the media has to be very, very careful, because the moment they repeat the lie and said, yeah, well, the guy apologized for that, you know, we take some responsibility for reintroducing the subject.
So we're not supposed to report it?
I don't know, Rex. I'm just telling you I'm very troubled by it.
You know, the point about taking something out of context or cutting the meat out of a quote, that's totally wrong. But what you got to understand here is that these shows really aren't new shows. They're entertainment shows, and you have to take them for what they're worth. I think people enjoy that part of it, but you've got to understand that that's what's happening.
Boy, is that true. That's a really great point. Kathleen Parker, the Pulitzer.
Are you patting each other on the back? Because I have a different view of
that. I was about to say. Kathleen Parker, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, said she was quoting Gary Ackerman, who's retiring you know, from Congress,
Gary Ackerman.
Saying that
I know.
He says that people are getting dumber. And he's saying people get confused and think there's no difference between news and entertainment. People who project themselves as journalists on television don't know the first thing about journalism. They are just stirring up a hockey game, says Gary Ackerman.
Now, let's remember that Gary Ackerman, who's no stranger to journalism since the way he got into politics was he owned a string of newspapers, community newspapers, said this. But interestingly, he said it after he announced that he wasn't going to run for office.
Right.
You don't really want to go running around saying, you know, the American people are getting dumber and dumber, which is true. Nevertheless, I've said it. And we all know it, because the more dumb they are, the more manipulable they are. And we have certainly seen our share of that. So you two come along and you say this business about, well, you know, this is just, we have to remember the distinction between news and these programs. It doesn't matter. This is politics. It's the allocation of resources. It is, they are being taken by the people as being legitimate news sources, and you two you know, stroke your chins.
And what are you going to do about it then, Ellen? Instead of just attacking us for pointing to the problem, what are you going to do about it?
The National Public Radio affiliate stations. We're reporting on the news. We're doing the hard...
So are we. What's your point?
We're doing God's work.
Oh, for God's sake. Keep up with the conversation here, would you? You know, we're talking about the fact that there is this problem, and you're just saying, oh, no, it's not a problem.
No, you're saying, you're going, tsk, this is terrible. They're not really journalists. That is no answer. And Judy...
We're pointing it out.
And Judy goes so far as to say, that's wrong, and we have to know that. People have to know that.
Here's
well,
what
how are you going to make them know it?
Man, it is hard to get a word in here, isn't it?
Man is right.
I think the information is out there. The good stories are out there. The good news programs are out there. The good radio programs are out there. And I think one of the things responsible news media organizations do is encourage people to learn about the important issues, to learn about the policies, to make sure that when someone's quoted, they're being quoted correctly, to make sure that they understand to go deep into any issue.
Well, you're right, of course, but you're also a goody two-shoes. That's what you are.
I know that exasperates you. It's true. I admit it.
Here's what Kathleen Parker says about this. She says, all freedoms depend first on freedom of speech, but not all speech is equivalent, no matter how many hits a website boasts or how many viewers age 25-54 tune in to a given TV show. And she represents that a good solution, since you're looking for solutions,
I am.
Is, this is going to set him off, news literacy training. Which, you know, I talk about a lot.
That's a great idea. Well, yes. Why are you against news literacy?
Well, it's not that I'm against it. It's that Rex has made this his big calling card, news literacy. He goes around, he talks at the Poynter Institute and places like that on news literacy. So every time he says the word news literacy, you know, I make sure that the self-serving button goes off.
Aimed at teaching. Why is it self-serving? I believe in teaching young people how to think critically and judge the quality of journalism.
Imagine the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And somebody goes and spits in the Pacific Ocean. What are the chances that the Pacific Ocean will be despoiled by one little guy?
Not much.
Spitting into the ocean. That's what you're doing with your news literacy.
You know what Theodore Roosevelt
spitting
said?
In the ocean.
Do you know, Judy, what Theodore Roosevelt said? I'll tell you what Theodore Roosevelt said. He said, I'm going to take a deep breath here. Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered with failure, than to take rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much nor suffer much, for theirs is the gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat.
My God, I'm sitting next to this man who can quote.
Yes,
that he
but the problem is he keeps using that one quote over and over and over again.
But the point is, it's not just spitting in the ocean. When you run a newspaper, you have a broad reach. When you run a radio station, you do have a broad reach, and you can make a difference. And you've got to try, and not just with young people, with older people. Teach them news literacy. There's tons of stuff a newspaper can do. There's lots of stuff a radio show and a television show can do. And I think those things are being done, and I think, you know, it's cynical to think it can't make a difference because slowly...
Hear, hear.
No. In case I've been misinterpreted, I just want to say that I think it's wonderful that you guys are... You know, sending a reporter in once a year to, you know, 35 kids in an upper class school to talk to them about news literacy. But that ain't our problem.
And our problem is?
That there's this, as Gary Ackerman says, this overwhelming dumbness that, you know, that a newspaper is saying, okay, we're going to send Rex to talk to the Emma Willard private school or something like that, is hardly the way in which we are going to rectify this terrible ignorance.
You know, one of the things we can do is make the stories we write really interesting or present the information in a compelling way. Maybe we're not doing enough as journalists to make what we do interesting.
Yeah, we need to dumb it down more.
By the way, Rex, I think that in your attempt to put me down, that was a profound point.
Uh-huh.
The fact of the matter is you go and you watch the National Institutes of Health or whoever are putting out information into a dumbed-down society. They use certain words, you know, as somebody who runs health shows and the rest of it, they use certain words which your daughter, you would not want your daughter to ever use in terms of describing, they want to prevent, for example, transmission of STDs and the rest of it. And so they will use words They won't say the word, the clinical word, penis.
Really?
They'll use another word. So your point about in the effort to make that communication, uh-huh. we are going lower and lower is a profound one.
Well, you know, it may be what's essential. Maybe if we bring language that people can understand, but you still
I'd like to see that on the front page of the Albany Times Union.
The difficulty, well, you know, we're getting there, but that's not the point is that we need to teach people, if we're not teaching them in their homes about sources that they can trust, we need to teach them to recognize advertising, public relations, publicity, raw data, and the journalism verification that we practice so they know what they're looking at when they see it. And by the way, the News Literacy Project, which Kathleen Parker, the columnist who's just quoting, has gone onto the board of, they do not go into elite private schools. They're in inner city schools. The National Center for News Literacy is based at Stony Brook University, where they're teaching with a Ford Foundation grant thousands of students, not journalism students. They're teaching college students who don't get this. They're teaching them this. And you should be very happy about this, Alan, because it may help assure that there will be an audience for the future for this radio station.
Very nice. Very nice, Rex. Very nice, Judy.
I'm
delighted that you're both working so hard at this. And by the way,
I'm sorry you're so cynical about it. Don't wish to engage.
I am cynical. But the truth of the matter is that I think it's a worthy goal. It's just that I have my doubts.
Well, that's good.
And time will tell.
Speaking of cynical, here is the worst thing that I've heard all week about journalism. That notable news organizations, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, Bloomberg, and Reuters, have agreed to let politicians and campaigns approve quotes prior to publication. I am not familiar with this. A story by Jeremy Peters in the New York Times reported that this has become standard practice now in Washington, that before a journalist uses a quote, they will send an interview to the source who gave them the interview, and we will come back crossed out. This is the only way in which these sources will agree to be interviewed now.
I want chance to check my quotes?
Yeah. No, not to send. The quotations, they're told beforehand, you know, the only way that we will allow this official of the Obama campaign, for example, to talk to you is the press office has veto power over what statements can be quoted and what can be attributed by name. And I've never heard of anything. I guess I'm too far removed from reporting because it's been 15 years since I was a reporter, but I'm pretty stunned by that.
I can't wait to hear what Judy has to say.
It's wrong. I mean, we don't do that. You can't do that. But it must be very competitive in Washington to try to get someone in a position of power to talk. But covering national politics is a different animal from covering local and state politics.
Well, the principle, though, is the same.
The principle,
I mean,
right.
In my case, I write a column. I like to check quotes with people. I always say the same thing. I'm going to check this with you, but I am not going to allow you to change it. In other words, I said, it's my column, it's my writing. I just want to make sure of the accuracy of the quote.
I think that's valid. That's a good practice.
Right. But it's the pre-publication approval and veto power that you're giving your sources, which is wrong.
It's exchange theory. That's what it is. You know, I have something of value. You want something of value. If you want it now, I dare say it's pretty evident to me that the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, doesn't really care for me that much. We've had some contretemps, and he doesn't, you know, come anywhere near the station. He will appear with Karen DeWitt, our Capitol correspondent, and the rest, but he's not going to talk to me. I don't care. In fact, if that's the price, it ain't worth it. You know, I wrote a column about him called Machiavelli. Cuomo's the new Machiavelli. He took some offense to that and had somebody call me up. I had a feeling he was standing right over the guy's shoulder. He's yelling at me. He's never coming on your air again, unquote. So tough noogies. That's just the way it is.
You know, in radio, of course, you have the guy's actual voice. And so the radio has the opportunity to say, you know, we can't engage in this kind of practice where you say we only let you use the quotes that we want you to use because you're right there on tape. But Dean Baquet, the managing editor of the New York Times, says we don't like the practice. We encourage our reporters to push back. Unfortunately, this practice is becoming increasingly common, and maybe we have to push back harder. I'd say so. I think all the reporters in Washington should say we will not tolerate this anymore.
You know, another dangerous trend we're seeing is that politicians will only send you an email quote. And how do you even know this politician said this?
Absolutely.
It was his own thought.
Good point.
They have complete control that way. And reporters are so desperate for some quote, will almost take anything they want, they can get. And what I want them to do is have an engage in a conversation with the politician or the spokesman so you can get the nuances of what they're talking
about. But they say, but boss, we tried, but they didn't give it to us.
All I got was this perfect email quote.
Yeah, and with an email, they can answer only part of the question, not all of it. And so you can't go back and say, but wait a minute, that's not what I asked you, Senator.
Yeah. I'm doing something you guys don't always do. I'm reading a book right now. the biography of Walter Cronkite, which is excellent, really great. And one of the things you get from the very beginning as he's over there with the Air Force embedded in World War II, one of the things you get is the incredible competition between reporters, you know, to the point where they got bosses sitting back there and they want to see them beat the competition, the rest of it. When you say they should all get together and insist that this not be done anymore, it gets right to the heart of this other issue, which is how competitive this business is.
That's interesting. You're right. You're right. Because what I'm suggesting really would be, well, I mean, you could call it collusion and restraint of trade, but it really is, though, reporters saying, we're not going to be manipulated by you politicians anymore. So I'm certain that some people would say, oh, no, I can be manipulated because I'll get the quote from this press secretary that you won't get. But they shouldn't.
Anyway. You know, I think at this point, all we can really do is point it out and say, this is what's happening, so the reader knows that this quote was, or this story is hampered by this this practice.
Well, they do. I mean, you see in an email, and the New York Times will always say, or quite often will say, in an email response to the question, so
yes,
that people can get that.
That's right. We really ought to do that. By the way, there's an interesting study that's just been done by a journal that you're probably familiar with, Alan, as a professional political scientist, a journal called Political...
I know the sharp knife is that when he says something like that. Right?
A journal called Political Communication,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I actually do know that.
Here's a study called Press Secretaries, Journalists, and Editors Shaping Local Congressional News Coverage. They tried to explore how the relationships, if there is a relationship between the way that press secretaries interact with reporters and the kind of coverage that results. And the press secretaries, this is for members of Congress, mentioned the relationship between the press and their office as being significant in giving them better news coverage. Now, just think about it for a second, and that means that a press secretary who is friendlier and has a warmer relationship is getting better coverage.
Of this there is no doubt.
Well, it shouldn't be true.
Oh, shouldn't. But the fact of the matter is, that's the way it works. You're either a friend or an enemy, or you're somebody who they like or respect, or you're somebody who they know. I mean, we got guys here in Albany. They work for some of the tabloids or something like that, or one of them anyway. And, you know, you just know, stay away from the guy. He's poison. Why would you entertain him? Because you know he's never going to give you an even break.
So I like to think that press secretaries who are good to the press are actually just doing a good job. That those who don't give us good access, who make our lives difficult, are doing a bad job. They're not doing us a favor. They're doing what they're hired to do, which is to serve the public by getting the information out. Again, I know that exasperates
like
you.
I
like it too, and I'm going to play a little violin
I used to be a congressional press secretary when I was a young man.
No.
True. And I was on that other side of the building. And I believe I was this little idealist who went off to Washington and I said, my job is to serve the media of the 2nd Congressional District. And I always responded to every phone call within an hour. That was my standard. You know, everybody got a call back and everything. And
did your congressman lose eventually?
Well, after I left him. But, you know, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. But in any, I don't mean
that.
No, he was a wonderful man.
Yeah, sure.
I admire him greatly. A brilliant man. He's a former professor like you, Alan.
But in my back of my head, I think that's really what the relationship be. And I know that in many cases, that's not exactly what's happening.
So
you have to realize that.
We've had a lot of topics here, and we've run out of time for this.
We have, but if I hired a press secretary and I was a congressman, I want the guy working for me or the woman working for me and not for to make sure. It would always be rationalized as working for the public. But we know what it's all about. Come on, grow up, everybody.
You're right. It's all about re-election. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, never mind.
Take that down on tape.
On
you're
that
right.
Cynical point. We have to go. Thanks for joining us, folks, on the Media Project.
Fancy, it's really quite a bar. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks, for readers, and to big shots.